Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, where we explore the ways in which we can and must power down in a new era that is no longer exploiting our fellow humans and ecosystems. We believe in building up our community resilience, expecting economic collapse in the face of abrupt climate change, the end of cheap oil, the depletion of our natural resources, and a possible mass extinction on our planet. I'm Bing Gong, and our co-host today in the studio are Mary Beth Brangan and James Heddle of Bolinas, and they're co-directors of EON, the Ecological Option Network, at eon3.org. You can find links to their blogs and their extensive video reporting on our show notes on our archive program, which you can get to by going to wmpostcarbon.com. They're currently at work on a forthcoming documentary entitled Shutdown, The California Fukushima Connection. You can find more about that project online at shutdown.doc, that's doc.tv, that's shutdown.tv. Today, in our nuclear news update, they're going to share with us some reports and interview bites from their ongoing video documentary production. Mary Beth and Jim, welcome to Post Carbon Radio. What have you got for us today?
Thanks, Bing.
Thanks, Bing. Hi. Well, today we want to share with listeners some of what we've learned in our recent taping trip to California's Diablo Canyon and San Onofre reactor communities, and an update on citizen efforts to monitor the impact of ongoing Fukushima radioactive emissions on the U.S. West Coast. So we're connecting and supporting the people that are working to prevent our own Fukushimas from happening. And we also want to counter the lies from the nuclear industry and those confused by it, like James Hansen, for instance, that nuclear power is a solution for climate change. And there are many, many reasons why this is not so, beginning with the fact that building a nuclear reactor and fabricating the nuclear fuel requires huge amounts of fossil fuels. And furthermore, the impossible task of sequestering the deadly resulting waste that will be hazardous for 250,000 years is energy intensive, to say the least, as well. And unspeakably energy intensive in even the first 20 years of grappling with how to deal with this. So in San Luis Obispo, we recorded a Nuclear Regulatory Commission community meeting on Pacific Gas and Electric's Diablo Canyon. There are two aging reactors there, located at the intersection of 13 earthquake faults. And we met with members of Mothers for Peace in San Luis Obispo who have actively been dealing with these reactors for over 30 years. And I just want to start out with a story about what happened at the NRC meeting. One of the members of the Mothers for Peace, who happens to be a man, male members of the Mothers are plentiful, he testified at the NRC meeting that he'd begun measuring the radiation levels because he lived in an area close to Diablo Canyon. And he had a good Geiger counter that was factory calibrated for accuracy. And the background radiation readings that he was getting, measuring day after day, were ranging between 29 counts per minute and 41 counts per minute day after day. But then all of a sudden, one day, the Geiger counter measured 684 counts per minute. So at that NRC meeting, we taped, he asked Diablo Canyon's PG&E management if they had released any radioactivity on that day. And they said they didn't know, but that they'd research it and get back to him. That's always the response when you get them into a corner where they don't want to tell you what they really need to tell you. So what people need to understand is nuclear reactors routinely release radioactivity in normal operations. They're allowed to, and then the utilities are allowed to self-report and to report only the averaged releases over a long period of time, like over a year. So residents aren't told when something that's called a batch release of radiation occurs, and that's disastrous for the residents that live close by. So and it's especially hard on the children. So afterwards, in Santa Barbara, we met with the director of the World Business Academy, whose name is Jerry Brown. Not the governor. This is a very different Jerry Brown. The World Business Academy has commissioned a recent study based on public health records of California, public health records that showed increased incidence of cancers and infant mortality in the zip codes closest to the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactors. And of course, that took drew a lot of criticism from the industry and from other public health officials who thought that, criticized it up one side and down the other. But it joins four European studies, one from France, one from Switzerland, Germany, and Great Britain, that also all showed increased childhood leukemia risk near nuclear power plants. And I did a bit more digging and found out that actually increases in childhood leukemias have been found not just in Europe and around Diablo Canyon, but all over the world. There's actually a stunning total of over 60 studies worldwide which have examined child cancers near nuclear facilities, with most of them finding cancer increases. So then we continued down south to one of California's other continuing nuclear threats, San Onofre.
Maybe listeners have seen the famous aerial photo taken at San Onofre a few weeks ago during the wildfires in Southern California. The picture shows the San Onofre nuclear plant with massive amounts of smoke coming from a wildfire just half a mile from where over 1,600 tons of the deadliest nuclear waste sits. The photo also shows bumper-to-bumper cars on Highway 5, which runs right along the nuclear plant, of people trying to escape the wildfires in both lanes, in direction going, the lanes going in both directions. So imagine what could have happened if the fires weren't stopped and burned into the plant or caused a prolonged outage of the electrical power needed to keep the radioactive waste consistently cooled to prevent releases or forced an evacuation of the entire staff. In fact, there was a partial staff evacuation. So coming up here in our first preview clip here is Senator Barbara Boxer grilling the NRC as to whether they will, as usual, grant the request of Southern California Edison, operator of San Onofre, to waive evacuation and safety plans now that the plant is in decommission mode.
To the chairman, is this not your quote? When asked whether or not a shutdown plant could be dangerous, this is what you said. The fire could well spread to older spent fuel. The long-term land contamination consequences of such an event could be significantly worse than those from Chernobyl. Do you remember saying that or writing that?
That's from the 2003 paper?
Yes.
It was a collaborative effort, that paper.
Did you sign that statement?
I am one of the authors. That is correct.
Thank you. And is it not true that the NRC said in 01, spent fuel fires could have health effects comparable to those of a severe reactor accident? Does anyone think that that's a misstatement by myself? Okay. My operator there for San Onofre submitted these many pages of exemption requests. Now, let me just tell you what they're asking for. This is what they're asking for. The operator is asking to discontinue off-site emergency planning activities and reduce the scope of on-site emergency planning. Examples of requirements subject to the proposed exemption that are related to discontinuing off-site emergency planning activities include, but are not limited to, requirements for off-site agency emergency plans, emergency planning zones, and ingestion pathway zones, the emergency operations facility, evacuation time estimates, off-site notification timeliness, off-site dose projections, protective action recommendations. Examples of requirements subject to the proposed exemption that are related to reducing the scope of on-site emergency planning activity. Look, they're basically asking to be let off the hook, and if you grant this exemption, you've never turned one down before, and you won't answer my question, none of you will. I'm going to show again the picture. I want Sam and Marky to see this, of how close a fire in California came to that decommissioned plant. Now, do any of you know how many hot fuel, spent fuel rods are in that plant?
I do not have an exact number. I can take that for the record. If you
anybody else know how many? Just for the record. 2,600. Do you know what it was designed for?
The original design or after the re-racking had been done? If it was the original design and the open frame racks, probably about a quarter of that amount.
1,300. So this doesn't even go into other decommissioned plants. So anyone who says that a shutdown plant is not as dangerous has to just read what the chairman herself said, read what the NRC said. The consequences of an event could be significantly worse than those from Chernobyl. And I got to tell you, I represent those people, just like Senator Vitter represents his people and worries night and day about their safety from hurricanes and the rest. I worry about my people. And I'm not going to stop because I can't get any one of you to commit to me that you will turn down this request for everything that they want to waive. And you've never turned it down before, and you won't answer the question. You do not know. Well, let me tell you, you better know, because I've got 8 million people that live within 50 miles of that site. I had a fire that came within half a mile of that site, and the operator had to evacuate the people inside. And now they don't want to have evacuation plans. This is a no-brainer. I'm sorry. You can sit there and say, we take it seriously? Really? Well, then let me just tell you. This facility sits on an earthquake zone, on a tsunami zone. You know it happens. You yourself wrote in a collaboration with other people that an accident here could be worse than Chernobyl. To me, there's an urgency. And to you, there should be an urgency. This isn't just any power plant. This is a nuclear power plant that has many of these spent fuel rods, okay? In an earthquake zone, a tsunami zone, and a fire came within half a mile. So I hope the staff will work overtime, just like my staff does when there's an emergency. So let me just tell you this. I am deeply troubled that commissioners haven't seen this. Commissioners, maybe they knew about the fire. If I were one of you, I certainly would have said, what's happening? This could have been, I don't even want to say, the type of disaster. All I have to do is quote the chairman in her 2003 paper in which she said, the fire could well spread to older spent fuel. The long-term land contamination consequences of such an event could be significantly worse than those from Chernobyl. Sam Vitter.
That was Barbara Boxer. Thank you, Barbara, for looking out for our interest. And what's next, Jim?
Well, I just want to comment a little bit that there is an that's the little fragment is just part of the ongoing dispute between the NRC and Barbara Boxer, who is demanding that they turn over records of the decision-making process that led to the installation of the faulty steam generators. And they're claiming that they don't have to respond to her authority, that rather the separation of powers gives them privacy rights in this area, when in fact the actual fact is that It's the Congress that created the NRC and which oversees it by plenary powers. And so eventually, let's hope they're going to have to turn over the decision-making processes. The reason that this is so important, and I'm glad, as you are, that Senator Boxer is pursuing it, there's more than 116 million people live within 10 miles of America's aging nuclear power plants. That's more than one-third of the population of the United States. The operators of these aging nuclear reactors want to extend their working lives decades longer than originally envisioned. That means installing many new parts and pieces on all of them. And most importantly, the NRC and the nuclear industry are treating the decommissioning process at San Onofre as the kind of model for what should go on at the rest of the country. I just want to conclude this segment with a brief quote from what Senator Boxer had to say. She said, "The Fukushima Near-Term Task Force, made up of NRC senior staff, recommended that 12 measures to upgrade nuclear safety in the wake of the Fukushima meltdowns be put into place. As of today, the NRC has failed to require reactor operators to complete implementation of a single one of these post-Fukushima safety measures. This is an unacceptable delay that puts the safety of the American people at risk." That's a quote from Senator Boxer. Now, yesterday, June 7th, was the one-year anniversary of the historic shutdown of the San Onofre nuclear power plant, located on multiple earthquake faults in a tsunami zone and a wildfire zone, just like Fukushima, between Los Angeles and San Diego. The local activist community was still basking in the well-deserved glow of success at helping to force the shutdown when they discovered their job was not over. Research by retired IT expert Donna Gilmore and others revealed that over 1,600 tons of highly radioactive waste was still slated to be stored indefinitely in the San Onofre's vulnerable earthquake, tsunami, and wildfire zone. And that wasn't the worst of the problem, but that unknown to almost everyone, the waste was much more radioactive, thermally hot, than before. It's called high burn-up fuel. And it must be cooled longer in the fuel pools and is having problems taking them out sooner, and it has to be in the long-term storage in an even more challenging and dangerous way. So Donna Gilmore is the founder of the excellent and well-documented website sanonofresafety.org, and in this upcoming clip she summarizes what her recent research has revealed.
After the plant shut down, I thought we were home free after San Onofre shut down. And then I started researching the nuclear waste, and I found out we have a major problem here at San Onofre and actually in the whole country. The waste is not being stored safely. It's stored in spent fuel pools that are very dangerous, require constant watering. They packed them really tight, so any safety mechanism they used to have aren't there anymore. They're using this zirconium cladding that even puts us at risk for a fire. And they're more vulnerable to terrorist attacks, so there's a lot of issues with the spent fuel. We're talking about moving it from the spent fuel pools into dry cask or dry canisters. And the canisters they want to put them in are not safe. There's fuel called high burn-up fuel. This is fuel that's they've allowed to burn longer in the reactor. It's they express it in terms of gigawatt days per ton of uranium. But basically, they've allowed them to increase the time the fuel burns in the reactor. Till now, it's up in this range, and the higher this goes, the higher the rate of this protective cladding failure. And the NRC and the industry, they have no solution for this. So they're putting fuel in canisters that could fail.
What does fail mean?
The cladding fails. Our first level of protection from radiation is gone. Our only other protection from the certain types of the radiation is in a canister that looks something like this. This is a canister, a stainless steel canister, 5/8 inch stainless steel. This one holds 24 fuel assemblies. This is a picture of an enlarged picture of a fuel assembly. The cladding is a real super thin layer of zirconium. All these rods, so these are all rods, and they're filled with pellets of uranium. And then each one of these goes into one of those holes in the canister. The cladding, this is a picture of the cladding breaking down, and this breaks down, the radiation can get out of that first level. So if this canister fails, the radiation will get out, and if we get oxygen in there, we could even have an explosion and have a major radiation release. They have what's called damaged fuel cans, which we're recommending. These are stainless steel cans that go around each fuel assembly, and then you put that into this bigger one. Our position is they should be used for all fuel because we do not know, there's no way to tell for sure that the cladding's failing or when it's going to fail, and we know with high burnup it can fail after it's in the dry canister. And being by the ocean, we have coastal corrosion issues. We can actually have cracking of this thin canister. This is an example of stress corrosion cracking. So you can actually have cracks going through that 5/8 inch stainless steel. Regarding the coastal corrosion, if we were to have a leak from these cracks, or a lot of times the crack can come from the seal. If it's a bolted canister, that's where the weakest link is, and then the weld in the canister, that's a weak link. If that is broken and that inner cladding is gone, then we'd have a major radiation explosion, and if oxygen gets to it, it can result in a hydrogen explosion, and then the radiation would go everywhere, like is happening at Fukushima right now on that scale, except it'll be right here in the United States. There's a document on the website, SaturnOfreeSafety.org, that goes into a detail about all the things they don't know, the monitoring we don't have to even know what's going on inside those canisters, and yet we're dealing with tons of radiation, much more than was at Chernobyl, much more that was in our atmospheric testing. So we could have millions of curies of cesium in our environment. We could basically lose Southern California here, damage our food supply for the nation, damage our import-export cargo business here, which is 40% for the nation. So this problem here at San Onofre will affect the whole world if we don't do this right. It's important that people get educated on this, because even people in the nuclear industry, even people at the NRC, don't understand details about this. There's been a lot of propaganda. One of the things that we really need is we need a study on what the best technology is for dry canisters, because what if we leave it up to what's happening down with the NRC, we're not going to have a good solution. We're not going to have a safe solution. These canisters are going to be here on site at all the reactors in the country for this probably 60 plus years. And so it's important for all of us to deal with this issue, because if we don't, nobody else is. And we're hoping to get funding to hire an independent expert to make recommendations on the best canister designs, and to have the lobbying and the legal power to make it happen. Okay. And for more information, you can check SaturnOfreeSafety.org. It has more information, and all the information is cited with scientific and government documents.
We're continuing with our nuclear news update with Eons at Ecology.
Ecological.
Thank you.
Options
Network with Mary Beth Brangan and James Heddle. What else do you have for us today, Mary Beth and James?
Well, we wanted to bring you just a brief update of an issue we talked about when we were last on your program, and that is what's going on at the WIP, the waste isolation pilot project in near Carlsbad, New Mexico. Both a fire and an explosion there, not just recently. Actually, the explosion occurred on Valentine's Day. And subsequent investigation and research by various agencies has, forced the closing, the indefinite closing of the WIP plant, which was supposed to last for, it was a demonstration project that was supposed to last for 10,000 years. It managed to get through the first 15 years without a major disaster. It may not reopen, but nobody knows at this point. So the explosion was caused by a number of factors, which all boil down to an erosion of the safety culture in the nuclear industry across the country, as well as an ignoring of local regulations and safety practice by the staff. There was the repackaging of the fuel procedure was changed, and with the introduction of a kind of kitty litter that created an explosive situation in some of the drums. They don't know how many. One of them did blow up down in the salt mine, half a mile below the surface of the New Mexico desert.
Well, they're estimating over 368 or something like that now.
Yeah, some of them were in shipping, in the process of being shipped there, and that has stopped temporarily for the moment. But then they were going to ship it to Texas, where they were going to be temporarily stored in an open pit in a county that has basically been taken over by the Harold Simmons Company waste handling specialists.
Waste control specialists.
Waste control specialists. So if it can't be stored to a half a mile underground safely, it certainly can't be stored in an open pit.
Over an aquifer, by the way. That's very important.
Over the Oglala Aquifer, which lies under at least six states and is the source of water for the food supply for the United States. This is a large subject, and we don't have time to go into it exhaustively. But we have discovered in the process that there is a kind of a shadowy agency called the National Nuclear Security Administration, which is supposed to be subsumed by the DOE, but actually essentially rules the roost. And they have been in the process of taking used nuclear fuel from other reactor sources around the world and bringing them to the United States to be reprocessed. Unfortunately, none of the reprocessing strategies have worked, and so there's an increasing accumulation of high-level radioactive waste in the United States from other sources as well as our own. This is a serious issue, and we'll report more on it in upcoming programs. Now I want to turn it over to Bing to tell about some...
Before we do that, Jim, we've got to play the PV clip and the Michael Aguirre.
Yes.
Could you introduce PV again and his outrageous remarks?
Right. Well, the San Onofre case is the current epicenter of a controversy with implications for all of the 100 U.S. reactor communities. And as we mentioned before, that means implications for 116 million U.S. residents who live within the 10 miles of the reactor, one-third of the total U.S. population, and also the rest of us who are going to be affected if one of these problems completely blows, which is increasingly likely with the foolhardy chances that the industry is taking and the lack of safety consciousness. They just don't care. So one of the recent California Public Utilities Commission proceedings recently was held on the issue of who was going to be paying what with the closed down San Onofre plant. And this clip that we're about to hear is when Michael Aguirre, who is a former San Diego city attorney, is questioning the owner of San Onofre, the president of Southern California Edison, as to how this settlement had been reached, because the settlement was behind closed doors and didn't include a discussion by everybody, did not include the examination of the decision-making process that would have established whether the decisions were made sensibly or not. And they came up with the ratepayers should be paying $3.3 billion of the $4.7 billion that the decommissioning is going to cost. So this is a clip of what happened when attorney Michael Aguirre was pressing on those questions.
And the remarks were made by the, California Public Utilities Commission president. What's his first name?
Michael Peavy.
Michael Peavy. So here it is. Just a little short little sequence here.
It's a ringtone, too.
Okay.
I'm not here to answer your goddamn questions.
Okay.
This is the kind of language. This is the kind of demeanor that the president of our California Public Utilities Commission is using in proceedings.
And I just cut it off because he also said, "Shut up, shut up."
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was definitely angered by Mike Aguirre's good cross-examination of the president of Southern California Edison, who operates and owns the majority of San Onofre. So now here's a clip from Mike Aguirre, who elicited that response from Mike Peavy, the CPUC president, in that hearing. Here's an interview clip from an interview we did with him afterwards in his San Diego high-rise.
I'm very happy to be having an opportunity to talk with you today. I know it's taken me about a week to overcome the emotional stress of Mr. Peavy's outrage. But anyway, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Well, give us the state of play of this so-called investigation at the CPUC and what your objections are to the way it's being conducted.
Well, the purpose of the proceeding is to figure out why the executives at Southern Cal Edison deployed steam generators that were supposed to last 20 years and only lasted 2, and related to that, why the ratepayers should then have to pay for the San Onofre power plant for the next 10 years, even though it's not going to be producing any electricity for them. That's really what the supposed purpose was of the investigation that was announced by the Public Utilities Commission in November of 2012.
And so what is the state of play currently at this date, last of May 2014?
Well, there was a well-orchestrated plan to never have an investigation into who was responsible for deploying the defective steam generators. There never was an honest effort to figure out whether it was reasonable to do that. And there was no effort to figure out whether an investigation into whether ratepayers should have to pay any more for the San Onofre plant. That we now know. So that's one thing that's been established. But beyond that, what has been established, there's nothing in the record that would allow the Public Utilities Commission to agree to the plan that's been put forward to end the investigation based upon the proposal that ratepayers pay another $3.3 billion. In order to get that plan that was announced, the so-called settlement agreement approved, the proponents had to show that they went through the steps of evaluating the strength of the case that ratepayers had, that they shouldn't have to pay anything more for San Onofre. And there has been an admission by the president of Southern Cal Edison, the primary proponent of the settlement, that there is nothing in the record that would allow the commission to make a judgment in favor of the settlement agreement.
What was the circumstance under which President Peavy had this outburst that led to this ringtone?
Mr. Peavy got peeved and then melted down after about 20 minutes of questioning of the president of Southern Cal Edison, who then admitted that there was no real basis for the settlement. And then when we turned to what the real reasons were behind what was being proposed by Southern Cal Edison, the president of Southern Cal Edison was asked, well, isn't it true that the value of your stock went up $160,000 on the day, a few days after the settlement was announced? The ALJ, who works for Mr. Peavy, wouldn't permit it. And then I said, well, you know, we have an offer of proof. We believe that there never was an intent to have this investigation. It was a promise of an investigation without the intent to perform. We think that the ALJ put off any investigation to the indefinite future, that she prohibited us from gathering any evidence about whether the deployment of steam generators was reasonable or not. And then there were these secret discussions aimed at figuring out how not ever to have the investigation. There was an announcement of the so-called settlement that was immediately joined in by the PUC president, PV, and by Florio, the assigned commissioner to this issue, claiming that they were happy that all of the parties had settled, even though there were many that were not going along with the settlement.
Are there implications of this, the outcome of this case, that go beyond San Onofre and California even?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that we have learned from Fukushima and what's happening in Japan right now is there is a covering up of the risks associated with these nuclear power plants. And we know in Japan there's been this change in government, much more conservative government, much more repressive government, a tyrannical threat, but most importantly, a controlling of the information. And only what the government wants you to know is being disclosed. And there's probably a lot of different reasons for that, but you see somewhat of the same situation here in with San Onofre. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has proven itself to be more of a cover-up artist, or more of a cover-up operation than a disclosure operation. Same is true with the Public Utilities Commission, and the public has a right to know what the safety threats are, what the financial threats are, what the game plan is for redeploying the nuclear waste. And I think that part of what's happening here is sending out a warning signal to the other 100 or so nuclear power plant communities, the communities that are housing those plants, that you better take a look at, number one, how is your nuclear waste being stored? How safe is it? What is the plan? You know, they have these they call them the burial costs. And that's, you know, the costs of what they say are the nuclear waste that's going to be buried. But the question is, no one knows where anything's going to be buried. They don't even know how it's going to be buried. San Onofre would never have been on the radar screen had it not been for the failure of these steam generators. We never would have started to grapple with this, because we would have just gone right ahead and, you know, not been aware of it. So because of this accident or this failure of judgment, we're now in a wholly different situation. And we now are, wait a second, this has been advanced. We are much more aware of the risks of getting rid of the nuclear waste. And all of the discussions, people like Donna Gilmore and others that are leading this effort, all of the discussion that's been taking place up to this point is the same people that were careless in deploying the steam generators are being just as careless in how they're going to store and transport and get rid of the nuclear waste. And the problem with that is that that is a much more serious, it's not just about dollars and cents, but that is a personal safety issue. You know, maybe it's time to go to the community and get the groups that are really knowledgeable about nuclear safety and nuclear, the cost of nuclear power, and that have been diligent and a real dedicated record of diligence on this issue. Maybe it's time to put them in charge for a while, you know, and put the people that are the most concerned about the people and not most concerned about profiteering. Maybe it's time for that, just for a change, you know, for the next few years. And you know, even if they do, the challenge is going to be great. You know, to figure this out is going to be really great. But, you know, if you don't try to figure it out, you're not going to figure it out. And at least you have to put people in there that are going to try to figure it out. We don't have that today. I mean, it's kind of ironic. You had the pipeline blow up in San Bruno with PG&E. You had the San Onofre meltdown with Southern Cal Edison. And then you had the firestorm with San Diego Gas and Electric. And all three of those problems, the Public Utilities Commission failed the public. And people are aware of that. That's, you know, San Bruno is very aggressive about it. And people, and as they start to dig in, and the same with San Onofre, same with San Diego with the fire, as people are digging in, they're finding out, hey, this isn't just about this one episode. This is a systemic problem. And California really is unique because it does have not only the highest prices, but its utilities are going up at about double what the national average is for as far as the costs and the amount that they're allowed to charge their returns on what they call their invested capital. You may not live in the Southern California area, or you might, but this injustice is a systemic problem. And to the extent that you can pick up the phone and just call your local legislator and say, you know, I don't like the way the Public Utilities Commission president speaks to people that go before the commission and cusses them out and tells them to shut up. You're tolerating something that shouldn't really exist. That's not really the way in which we think. You are public servants. That doesn't sound like a public servant. That sounds like a tyrannical public official. And we don't want that. And we want you to do something about it. We need that fellow to move on. And we need the message to go out, no, ratepayers shouldn't pay for the mistakes of Southern Cal Edison. And not only that, but you should pay the money back. And beyond that, the federal government should conduct, as Senator Boxer has asked, we need a criminal investigation of this. This is taking money from people under false pretenses. Why can't we go after people who are in positions of responsibility, who have no excuses except for their unbridled greed for doing this? Why can't we go after them? Those are the things that we need people to call up their elected officials and just calmly and rationally get those points across. The thing people have to understand is the Public Utility Commissioners are supposed to be making decisions in the open so we can observe what's influencing their decisions. The decisions at the Public Utilities Commission, you know, there must be some underground bunker that they all go to and make their decisions in secret, because there is no way that when you look at the public record that you can understand how they go about making their decisions. And that is a constitutional, state of California constitutional right that all Californians have, to observe their Public Utilities Commissioners making the decisions in their as a group. And that is being denied to them. The decisions are made behind closed doors in what they call ex-party meetings. The whole point about Mr. Peavy was asking him, hey, what, you know, you've been making decisions with Southern Cal Edison. Why don't you tell us how that worked? And that's when he said, I don't have to answer your question. I don't have to answer the question of whether I was meeting in secret with Southern California Edison, plotting how not to investigate the unreasonable conduct of Southern California Edison's executives. I don't have to answer your question about how I was able to orchestrate this whole facade of a settlement. I don't have to answer your questions about how much I've been involved in this whole process that you don't know about. Shut up. Just shut up. And, you know, that's the attitude that people have, is the people of California, from, you know, the Public Utilities Commission, colon, to the people of California, shut up. I don't have to answer your questions. And that's, right now, we don't have any politicians saying otherwise. We hope, with the public hearing this and seeing this, that maybe we can get some politicians to call up the Public Utilities Commission and maybe they can ask them.
You've been listening to Mike Legere, who represents low-income Edison rate payers as an intervener at the California Public Utilities Commission. Now I'd like to say a few words about what we're doing here in Point Reyes to monitor the Fukushima ocean radiation, which after 3 years, the Fukushima disaster was March 11th, 2011, and that ocean water that continually contaminated radioactive isotopes are going into the ocean, 300 to 400 tons of water every day. And now I understand there's concern about strontium getting into the Pacific Ocean. So I was able to, since there was no government agency stepping forward to monitor, we the citizens had to do it, and I put out a plea for some funds to cover this sampling just off of Point Reyes. And what we do is take a 5-gallon container of water sent to us by Ken Bessler, who's a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute on Cape Cod. And then we have Tom Beatty, who's an Inverness fisherman, take the container out there and fill it with water. And then we ship it back to Ken Bessler for analysis. Well, we've done two of those samples already, one at the first of the year and then just one in the first part of April. And there has been no detection of cesium, the fingerprint of Fukushima, so far. And our next sample will be on around July 1, I believe, and we'll see what happens then. And then the results will be posted to the website called Radioactive Ocean, ourradioactiveocean.org. So stay tuned, and we'll keep you abreast. And we have a little clip here of Ken Bessler, who was here in Sonoma giving a presentation on his work. And this is him at California's Bodega Head with a 5-gallon container.
What is this, Ken?
This is it. This is the kit. So this is how we're going to collect the water. In this cubitainer, collapsible containers, holds about 5 gallons or 20 liters. And if you listen inside of it, something bouncing around. It's orange on the top is a temperature probe. And what we're trying to do is not only measure cesium in here, but look at the water properties and temperature, and we'll later analyze for salinity, salt content, are the two primary things that drive ocean currents and tell us where the water came from. So, a combination of things.
Let's see. How about introducing our next clip, Mary Beth?
Okay. Well, there was symbolic significance in the taking of the sample at Bodega Head, because that is the location of a proposed nuclear reactor site that PG&E wanted to build a long time ago that was discovered to be right on the San Andreas Fault. So here's, and it was defeated by successful citizen research and organizing. So here's John Bertucci, who's a co-founder of Fukushima Response and organizer of the event that brought Ken Bessler and Dan Scythe of International Medcom to speak in Petaluma last week. And John tells the story of what's now called the hole in the head.
PG&E intended to build a nuclear power plant right here, a reactor. And big dream. Developers were already thinking there'd be a freeway from here to San Francisco along the coast. Local activists got wind of the story. Now, the way it works is the same old story. They get They go through the courts, they get the permissions, they got a public relations grant, and they were steamrolling this through with politicians who were making decisions without really public comment. So the activists banded together and started a campaign to make the public comment. And some fortuitous things happened. There were Malvina Reynolds, I don't know if you remember, Little Boxes. Mm. She wrote a song against the reactor. Okay, that got traction. The editor of the Chronicle was on vacation, and the assistant editor got a big story in about the danger. So that got a lot of press. They did demonstrations here where they had balloons, helium balloons, with strontium written on it. They release them. They float south. They lose the helium and drop in your backyard, and you read, "You're holding strontium from the Bodega Bay power plant." So the consciousness went, and this was early 60s, so there was a sense of resistance. But the final blow was a UC geologist came out, climbed into the hole, said, "You're on the San Andreas fault. Bad idea." Yeah. And I believe at that point the AEA backed out.
AEC
backed out, and PG&E sort of washed their hands of it. So this hole would have been
the foundation of a
So we would Bodega Bay would have been a nice warm place to swim then, right?
Yeah. Well, that was one of the arguments. There was a lot of people who said it's going to warm up the water and kill the fish.
Yeah.
We live
on
that fish.
So after that inspiring story of a successful citizens' campaign to close down a proposed nuclear plant, here's another inspiring story. This one's from Japan. Citizens in Japan filed a lawsuit that resulted in a recent court victory, which is very unusual. The court in the Fukui Prefecture ruled that the Ohai reactors would not be permitted to restart. And these are reactors west of Tokyo. There have been massive public resistance to restarting the reactors, but the current administration in Japan, of course, wants to go ahead and do that. And the judge said that even though this might be a short-term consideration for the economy, the risk of losing their homeland would be far worse and would be the true disaster, and was very impatient with the argument that this had to be done for economic reasons, and that Fukushima disaster has been the worst environmental catastrophe in their country in their country's history, and that if the real disaster is when you can't use your land anymore. So we were very edified and inspired by that result and that decision. And even though it'll be probably appealed and may even be overturned, it did set an important precedent.
Because they want to restart all 50 reactors that are now out of service.
That's right.
Okay, well, I think we have to wrap that up. It's been a full hour show with a lot of reporting. Thank you, Mary Beth Brandgen and James Heddle of EONS, and all the wonderful work you're doing to keep us aware of what's happening. And Mary Beth and Jim will be back on Post Carbon Radio next month for another nuclear news update on the second Monday of July. So you can listen to this and other archive podcasts of our program on postcarbon on wmpostcarbon.com.